good evening. I'm your host, Aaron Ripmaster. Welcome to the Man Cave, where joining me tonight to record Diz Dad's podcast number 356 for December 20th, 2015 are David Nicely.
Hi, everybody.
Jeff Swearingen.
Hello.
And Brett Williams.
Good evening, everybody.
So here we are, just on the cusp of the release of Star Wars 7, The Force Awakens. Actually, you know, when this podcast comes out, the movie will have just come out, will be, you know, on opening weekend. And last week, we kicked off this series by doing a kind of an introduction to the original Star Wars trilogy. This week, I'm sorry, we had to do it. This week, we're going to take a similar journey through the prequel trilogy of the Star Wars series, just to kind of make sure that everybody going into Force Awakens has a full picture of what has gone before. But before we get into this, I'm sure to be, you know, intellectually scintillating discussion of the Star Wars prequels. I do want to take a moment and remind you that the Diz Dads podcast is sponsored by Fantastic Memories Travel and its Mouse Master Travel Group. The Mouse Master Travel Group focuses on Disney destination vacations, and Mouse Master agents would love to take care of the stressful parts of vacation planning so you can focus on the fun. You can check us out at mousemastertravel.com. So we've kind of given the prequel trilogy, you know, its pokes in the ribs, really at every opportunity leading up to episode 7, The Force Awakens. But, you know, it was kind of a big deal when we were getting ready for these movies to come out. There was some, you know, we talked last week about the cultural significance of the original trilogy coming out at the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, really kind of being a creature of their times. But in some of the same ways, you know, Phantom Menace coming out in 1999 was a big deal. And I don't know, you know, Jeff, you want to talk a little bit about the anticipation level when, you know, Phantom Menace was ramping up there in 1999.
Oh, geez. Well, even before that, in 97, when the special editions came out, you had people lining up around the block to get in the movies again. And even with episode 1 when it came out, I remember camping out for 12 hours for tickets for that movie, not realizing what I was about to go through. But this was an event.
Yeah. I mean, this was a big deal. How about you, Brett? Do you have any particular memories of the 1999 release of episode 1 and kind of the lead into the prequel trilogy?
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, people were jonesing for Star Wars, and I think a lot of it was just pure nostalgia for a lot of people that, I mean, clearly it was a movie that became part of pop culture, and it was, you know, something that everyone knew. So just to kind of relive that a little bit with the introduction of the prequels, I mean, there was a lot of excitement around it. No, it's not the same as the ones that are coming out now, because you have, you know, Han Solo, Luke Skywalker, all those types of original characters, but it's still just the thought process around reintroducing Star Wars to everyone again as a new film was, you know, very, very exciting.
Sure. How about you, David? Any particular memories of the you know, lead up to Phantom Menace?
Yeah, I remember taking my wife to the movies just so we could see a trailer, and then we left. We didn't stay for the movie.
Wow. I would have done that too.
I just wanted to see the trailer, and you know, those were the days before YouTube, so we couldn't hire anything online.
Right.
I too camped, you know, for tickets, and you know, the other thing too, for those of us who grew up with the original three, this was really the first time, at least, you know, for people my age, we were adults when a Star Wars movie was coming out.
Right.
So it kind of felt like, you know, it was kind of our time that, you know, we could go to the theaters, we could afford the merchandise, we didn't have to beg for it for Christmas. So things were kind of changing. We were kind of growing up with it. And there was as the other guy said, a great deal of anticipation to see where the story was, even though it was a prequel, you know, how the story was going to get us to episode 4.
Right. So that's an important thing to point out, is that And I think in a lot of ways is a big difference from now the lead up to episode 7 was that the lead up to Phantom Menace was a lot different because it was so consciously not the original movies. You know, not only was it not telling a story going forward from what we already knew, but, you know, the original movies, a big part of its charm, I guess, is that with the exception of Alec Guinness, it was nothing but unknowns, right? Nobody knew who Mark Hamill was. Nobody knew who Carrie Fisher was when those movies first came out. And Phantom Menace, by comparison at least, I mean, it had stars. You know, it had Liam Neeson, it had Ewan McGregor, it had Natalie Portman. And Portman and McGregor may have been sort of more towards the beginning of their careers, but they had already made big movies by this time.
Yeah, Samuel L. Jackson was a pretty big star by that point.
Well, there you go. Yeah, I mean, Samuel L. Jackson, who had a relatively small role, but was a big name. And so we knew going in, we were getting something that was clearly different. We all got all pumped up. We got excited about Phantom Menace and it made a lot of money. You know, it was pretty darn successful. So it must have done something right. We make a lot of fun of it. If you could pick something to say, you know, yeah, it takes a knock, but this is something Phantom Menace got right. What would you say would be something it got right?
I think the pod racing scene was something that we hadn't, you know, that really took advantage of the special effects at the time. And okay. They did a fantastic job with that. You know, it turned into video games. You know, it was it was just one of those where it kind of changed. We hadn't really seen anything like when the other movies with like starfighter scenes or scenes where there were, you know, chase scenes in terms of space that were real long. And here we had a good, I can't remember the exact block of time, but there's got to be at least 3 to 5 minutes of pod race there.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that was a remarkably impressive feat. And that's an important point is that, again, just as in some ways Star Wars set the bar in the, you know, in its original era for movie special effects in a very similar way, you know, this was a Hollywood in the late 90s, early 2000s that was about big effects. And that really kind of, you know, was obvious from the get-go of The Phantom Menace. It had a very futuristic and very lush special effects feel. I don't know, Jeff, anything you would say that they got right out of the box in Phantom Menace?
I don't know if it's right out of the box, but it's definitely something that you should look at in comparison to the original trilogy. The battles in the original trilogy, the lightsaber duels, they're very slow and methodical, and it's almost like fencing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're very much sword fights.
You don't see that in Phantom Menace. It's turned into martial arts.
That's true.
Well, I mean, well, Ray Park, who played Darth Maul, is a martial arts expert that was brought in for this. And these battles are very choreographed. They are a lot faster. They have a different feeling of excitement than the ones in the original trilogy. You can either, and that there are two ways you can look at that. I personally prefer the physicality of the original ones, but I love watching Darth Maul when he's going at both Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan at the same time in the power chambers because it is brilliant to watch.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a unique aesthetic that they kind of created for those battles. And I would agree that would be something that, you know, the prequels got right.
Yeah.
How about you, Brett? Something that you feel like the prequels got right?
Yeah, I mean, the plot. Even with the first one, which is probably the the least exciting of the prequels to me, is that they didn't jump forward. They were starting to set things up. And I think they did a nice job of that, whether it was, you know, introducing a different Sith Lord in Darth Maul, or, you know, just showing Anakin Skywalker in his very, you know, youth. I mean, he was very young, and you just think of Anakin Skywalker as, you know, Darth Vader. And, you know, part of the prequels is you want to see that evolution, and you can't just jump to it. So I thought they did a nice job of kind of prefacing, you know, what was to come in Star Wars: A New Hope.
Okay. Okay. I mean, that's an interesting point. You know, that was one of the things that has always struck me as being kind of strange, that first of all, let's put to lie the myth, right? I mean, there was always that myth, and I remember it even as far back as, you know, being a kid in the 80s during the time when the first trilogy was coming out. There was always that rumor, and I think that George Lucas sort of encouraged it, that Lucas had this grand vision originally of, you know, a trilogy of trilogies, and that there was some grand plan for 9 films right from the beginning. And I think we all know pretty well that was just posturing, that was never true. I mean, are we agreed on that now?
Without a doubt. I mean, 1, 2, 3 came together because he had a wild weekend in Tijuana, got drunk. You know, drummed up Jar Jar and a bunch of other stuff. So, yeah, we all know that George made that up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are obvious tip-offs, including the fact that, you know, the changes to the relationship between, you know, Luke and Leia come so late in the development of the script that if you watch one by itself and then know from the beginning that they're brother and sister, it can be downright creepy at times. Because I don't think that, I mean, they hadn't decided that they were brother and sister until too late to really change all of the script. So to suggest that they had all 9 mapped out, it just wasn't ever true. And so from that perspective, once you know that that's the case, is it just me, or does it even now seem a little odd that they elected to tell the backstory next?
I often wondered if he didn't have a forward story. If the books that were licensed out to be written, it kind of went a couple different directions, and he didn't want to go on to that canon.
Oh, interesting.
So the only thing that he could go, you know, the I shouldn't say the only thing, but maybe that his decision was to go backwards, because that would still be his own.
Right, right. That's a really interesting point. That there was this expanded universe out there of, you know, novels and other things that were being written going forward, and so, you know, maybe this was a way to get a clean break and have a blank slate to work with.
Well, I think that he had this backstory from the beginning, and just not fully fleshed out. I doubt that Jar Jar was there from page 1, but there was somewhere that I saw that once he had seen the special effects that had been done in Jurassic Park, then he wanted to go back and to be able to tell the backstory for Anakin, because he wanted to know that the technology was there to show Yoda in a lightsaber battle.
Okay. Well, that's interesting that would be an almost an argument by itself, that because by the end of Return of the Jedi, Yoda's dead, if he wants to use Yoda, he has to go backwards.
Right. And we've always wanted to see the battle we've heard about for years of what would have caused Anakin and Obi-Wan to fall apart in the volcano. We had always wanted to understand what happened in that throwaway line in episode 4 about the Clone Wars.
Right, right.
So I think it would have been natural to go back and tell that. if we had just avoided all the extra things to sell toys.
Well, and I mean, the point about Yoda is applicable to Ben Kenobi as well, right? I mean, if you want to bring Ben back, you can only do so many of the visionary scenes where he talks from beyond the grave, you know, to Luke Skywalker. So I think that plays into it as well. And how many times did Ben Kenobi actually reference Luke's father, you know, during the trilogy? So
right, and to be honest, you know, putting myself back in my shoes, you know, back in the late 90s, and you know, leading up to Phantom Menace, I got to admit that that's a story that I had been speculating about and talking to my friends about and wondering about for, you know, 10 years, 20 years since the last group of Star Wars films had been out. I mean, we all wanted to know the answer to that story back then.
Now we know.
We're not sure we wanted to.
Well, I was going to say, what's really actually funny about that is I was in college in like 94 through 97, and we used to have hotly contested debates about things within the Star Wars trilogy. And one I will never forget my roommate talking about was Yoda. He's like, how can Yoda hold a lightsaber? How can this guy be this Jedi? He's got, you know, a claw. Mm-hmm. And then lo and behold, we see Yoda with a lightsaber.
Right, right. All right. All right. So I guess, you know, the point then is that looking back, these movies, you know, take a pretty hard hit, I think. You know, we are less than kind in our evaluation, I think, of the prequel films. But in their context, and really if we go into it the way we went into it when they first came out, I almost wonder whether our expectations were such that it wouldn't have mattered what they had produced. It couldn't have reached what we wanted or what we expected.
Go ahead, Jeff.
I was just going to say, I think that's a very fair assessment because of the wildly, you know, just how successful that Star Wars was. And I mean, for me, again, Star Wars was the very first movie I saw in a theater, and it was part of my childhood, owning tons of the action figures, everything. So as I previously mentioned, there was that nostalgia feel. So it's right. Like, hey, we're going to get to go back and do this. And then you saw it, and it's like, didn't quite live up to the hype that I thought, but.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, let's actually be fair here too, because if you look at 1990 movie releases, I went ahead and pulled them up on Box Office Mojo, right? It's not even close. Phantom Menace grossed a little over $431 million in 1999. Now, I know that doesn't sound like as much when you think about the billion-dollar box offices that Avengers movies pull now, but to put it in context, the second highest grossing movie of 1999 was The Sixth Sense at just over $290 million. So it made close to twice what the next highest grossing film of the entire year made.
And that's still almost a half of, you know, half a billion dollars.
Yeah, and I mean, it was $431 million.
I mean, in today's money, that's more than Avengers.
It's an insane amount of money. And it didn't open until the middle of May. I mean, it didn't even make that money in a full year.
Exactly. And I think Brett's right. You know, no matter what would have happened, I don't know, their expectations would have been met. I think for some people's disappointments, like myself, who also saw Star Wars as the very first movie they ever saw in a theater, the reliance on special effects may have been the ultimate downfall because it lost some of the depth and feeling of the original. But I heard something interesting today talking with someone going into one of those debates, that they needed these three to fail in order for us to be looking so forward to the next ones.
Oh, interesting.
That if they'd have been huge successes, would these have had to live up to the same thing that the first three had to go through?
Yeah. That's an interesting point. I mean, I guess we've all reached the point on the on this next one where we say, you know, everything that we see that looks decent, it gives us this hint that it can't be as bad as what we saw in the prequels. So we're excited. All right, well, before we leave the overview, I think we have to address what are probably I'm going to say the four biggest complaints. I think that people make, and you guys can correct me if I misidentify these, but the four biggest complaints that people tend to have about the prequels are, number one, some real harsh criticism of the acting of the young actors who are playing characters that we either know about and love, even though we never met them in the first movie, or playing characters that we know as adults from the original trilogy. So number one is major criticism of those actors. Number two is Jar Jar. Number three is the mind sink that comes from getting all tied into this whole midichlorian thing as the source of the force sensitivity. And then the fourth, I would say, is the shall we say, rather stiff dialogue in general. That's what I would identify as probably the four main criticisms. And anybody want to argue with me there, say that there's a bigger one out there, or that I'm misidentifying any of those?
Other than Jar Jar Binks is three?
They weren't in any ranked order there.
No, I meant jar, as in one, jar two, and then pink three, then you can add a fourth. No, I would go back on, I don't know that, I would, the stiff dialogue, I would almost replace again with the, that's so heavy reliance on green screen. You know, that's okay. One of the things that whenever watching it, it's just really difficult for me to get around because you just don't have that sense of, and with the young actors, sometimes it's very evident that they're not on a physical set.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good point.
I think my other issue that episode one isn't necessary.
Okay.
I mean, when you look at the plot points that happen in it and you look at the others that are relevant to 4, 5, and 6, there's nothing that is necessary in episode one. It's just there to show Obi-Wan finding Anakin. That's it.
Right.
I can't think of another relevant plot point out of that movie that carries forward.
I mean, I guess you could say that to some extent, you know, episode one is sort of if it was a book prologue, you know, it would be a paragraph instead of a whole chapter.
I would give it maybe two sentences.
Okay. All right. Well, okay. So
it just feels like two hours of bloat.
Mm-hmm.
That once you get done and you have actually watched all six, this was kind of like the chapter that you could have skipped in the book.
Right. We're going to talk a little bit more about that near the end of this, this recording. So near the end of this episode. So let's hold off on going too much farther down that road, because I think that that's a significant part of, we're going to talk near the end about the sort of overall, the approach you ought to take to watching the two trilogies in preparing for, going to see, Force Awakens if you haven't already done that. So, episode one and where it falls, I think, is kind of at the heart of that debate. So let's just very quickly, anybody have any other things they want to add about criticisms of the original trilogy? Because I want to say that I think that the talk about too much reliance on green screen and special effect as opposed to physical effect is a really good point, and one that I overlooked a bit. So I would agree that that's a big part of – I'm a little conflicted, I guess, on that point, because I agree that it tended to make things really stiff and artificial. And on the other hand, they did a really nice job of creating some beautiful environments. They just, they only worked from a distance. You know what I mean? They were beautiful. And then when you got up close, it was just too much, too artificial.
Well, there's two things that I was going to mention. One was along with the technology and special effects that they used that I felt – and I mean, yes, with the green screen technology and everything you point out, it was very staged. But I almost felt that some of the technology – because this was, again, supposed to be taking place, you know, like 25 years before A New Hope. Right. But it seemed so much more advanced when you just saw some of the technology within – that actual world, not talking about the movie, but within the Star Wars world. It's almost like you would have expected to be a little bit more archaic in the technology to evolve. But just looking at some of the creatures, some of the robots, things like that, it was clear that that movie was made so many years later. And that just bothered me personally. I don't know if it was like an OCD type of thing of like, okay, wait a second. I'm like, we had basically like three types of, you know, blasters in the Star Wars trilogy. And now I'm looking at all these different characters and what they have. And it bothered me a little bit. And then the second thing that bothered me was, and we talked about this a little bit, was the known actors. Like, I would have much rather gone in with a no concept of these actors or actresses and what they had done in any other movies. Like, show me someone that hasn't done anything. Like Samuel L. Jackson, I know it was a small role, but him and Jimmy Smits and some of the others, I was just like, well, yeah, this is great, but it just has a completely different feel to the movie because you are accomplished actors. We know who you are. We know what you've done.
Yeah, and it was a little difficult to see them in the Star Wars universe as anything other than Samuel L. Jackson and Jimmy Smits. I think that's reasonable. I mean, I guess it didn't bother me so much that it was cleaner, because to me, what that was showing me was the difference between sort of glory days of the Republic and what happens on the fringes of the galaxy under the Empire. You know, that the original trilogy films, even though they are later in time, they are also later in the ongoing war and at the fringes of the galaxy, as opposed to sort of in the core of things in the home planet, in the, you know, heyday of the Republic. So that, I guess, that to me, the original trilogy showed the decay of the Republic.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that one of the things that I had read as a point of view on that was showing what the oppression would do
into
a society, or to, in this case, you know, a galaxy, that they were taking away, you know, those freedoms of, you know, design, or, you know, of expression through design, you know, and everything would just be simple and cold.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go ahead and start working our way through the films, just so the people who didn't have them, you know, on the one hand, if you haven't already seen the movie, you're probably looking to go see Force Awakens soon. You know, this will save you from having to sit through, 8.5, 9 hours of prequel film if you feel like you don't want to see that, or you know, want to skip it and get your you know, sense of what those films were about, so that, you know, you'll have a complete picture of the story leading into Force Awakens. And so the story starts, obviously, with Phantom Menace. And David, you were you either volunteered or were volunteered to lead us through the story. Give us a guided tour of the plot of Phantom Menace.
Sure. And if no one's ever seen it, don't spend a lot of time, you know, thinking you got to watch the whole thing. But so the basic overview is that the Jedi are sent in to negotiate this Trade Federation blockade that is blocking the planet of Naboo illegally, according to the Senate. While they're there, they're attacked. They feel that there's some kind of strange workings going on. They have to take the Queen and escape. And rescue her off Naboo as they're trying to be attacked there, and they land in some foreign planet called Tatooine, and while they're there trying to get a starship, they actually meet Anakin Skywalker. From there, you know, the story just kind of does a lot of rambling on that would be tough to digest, but there's a couple of subplots, I guess. One would be that Anakin does meet the future mother of his children, who will be, you know, featured in episodes 4, 5, and 6, and 7. We also see that Anakin is going to be trained as a Jedi and that he has very special powers. The pod race is certainly worth watching. If you don't want to watch it in the film, you can YouTube it.
Before we get away, this is an area where episode 1, Phantom Menace, takes a lot of criticism and took a lot of criticism at the time, because in this scene we have it's pretty clear, it's not overt, but that Anakin's mother is essentially a slave. And yep. The characterization of the slave owner / junk shop owner took a lot of criticism. You know, he was an over the top character, and you know, some people were really uncomfortable with that portrayal.
Yeah, you know, and this is one of the things that I've kind of been really rough on George Lucas about. I know that George financed these movies by himself, and I know it's, you know, a lot of it was funded through obviously the success of the other Star Wars movies that led into Industrial Light and Magic and Skywalker Sound. But this, and I mean this sincerely, this is why sometimes that even adults need supervision. George made a movie without anyone telling him no. And I think that he did some things in the movie that, had it been financed by a studio, would not have happened.
That's a good point.
And I really mean that in terms of, because I've, you know, that same criticism is there. I don't know that it certainly wasn't subtle at all, not at least in my opinion. But I think that's one of the issues, that when you have that much money and can do whatever you want, there's not a whole lot of people around to tell you no.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Okay, so the first probably third of the movie or so is just all of this setting up, you know, who Anakin Skywalker is, recognizing that even as a small child, he has these gifts, and giving us this initial encounter with Queen Amidala, who is essentially a child queen.
Yeah, and I think one of the other things, uncomfortable things too, is the obvious age difference between Natalie Portman and Jake Lloyd.
Yes.
in the movie, because it's going to take a huge change into the next movie. And I realize that when boys hit puberty, we change quick, but usually not that quick. but maybe things are different in a galaxy far, far away. You have the meeting from there. And then, you know, as the next part in the next third of the movie goes, you know, there's, I think, a little bit more about this dark feeling that Master Yoda and Master Windu feel, and that is it possible that the Sith are coming back? And so we see the rumblings of Darth Sidious for the first time in dealing with the Trade Federation and introducing his apprentice, Darth Maul. And the Jedi have their first encounter on Naboo in the plane hangar with the Sith, even though it's a short encounter.
Okay. And from, you know, as pretty much all, Star Wars universe movies go, right? You get your initial setting, and then we're going to travel to a new setting. So we started with, you know, the battle, and then moved to Tatooine. We have the initial confrontation with the Sith on Tatooine, and then we have to move again, and we head over to, Coruscant, where we have the Jedi Council, and this is, you know, you just kind of got us through the basic Jedi Council story. Now, we have glossed so far over our friends, the Gungans.
That was intentional, Aaron. that's for my good, close, dear personal friend, Jason Mitz. He wanted to do a whole segment on Jar Jar. I didn't really feel it was needed. We did go over the Gungans, which, again, it's no one told George no. And he decided to create this whole underworld that's under Naboo of these people. And unfortunately, we don't see – or I should say, we see a good amount of them, but we don't get a lot of their story in this first part of the movie. It's mainly just dealing with Jar Jar and kind of the blundering idiot that he is.
All right. So I have to ask at this point, you know, we can't get around talking about it. Jar Jar is obviously the single greatest thing, greatest criticism of these films. I mean, there are entire categories of memes that have grown up around hatred of Jar Jar. We know that our good friend Jason Mitz worships Jar Jar. So there's both sides of the coin. But I have to ask, have any of the three of you seen the extended speculation that has been floating around the internet over the last few months arguing that Jar Jar would have been fine except that Lucas got forced to pull back from what he really would have done with Jar Jar because ultimately Jar Jar was supposed to be the hidden hand behind it all, the ultimate bad guy?
I thought he was Darth Vader. He's the guy in the mask. That's what Jason says.
I mean, seriously, had any of you read the that piece?
I have not.
Okay.
I haven't.
No. All right. No, but I've seen some other stuff on Jar Jar, and I thought you were going a slightly different direction with it.
It's just basically a fan-written piece. I think it originated on Reddit. It's actually kind of interesting. He basically makes an argument based on a few isolated pieces that if you compare the way that Jar Jar moves and the way that things happen, there's an argument to be made that he's obviously much more talented and skilled than he lets on, and that therefore the bumbling fool stuff must be a put on, and that he's intentionally sort of using that to allow him to hide in the shadows because, as we'll see going forward, when major things happen, for no explainable reason, Jar Jar is right at the base of them and often is causing whatever, you know, it's his fault when something happens. Even though there's no logical reason for it.
Okay, so you did go where I thought you were going, and I did see what you saw. Okay. It was a series of things that showed, like the one battle scene where Jar Jar go through, and it shows his movements reflecting those of a skilled Jedi. And it looks clearly like he had – I mean, in the movie, it was designed to look like, oh, he's just this bumbling idiot, and he shoots this guy, does this, and everything else, and then – when you sit down and dissect it, you can say, well, no, well, he looked like a bumbling idiot. No, he was actually a very skilled, you know, warrior. And as you said, was a mastermind. Yeah, it's an interesting piece.
Right. I mean, the core of the argument is that all of his movements are drunken master kung fu, basically. That's designed to lull you into thinking that he's incompetent and clumsy when actually he's, you know, unusually highly skilled and just fooling you.
Well, if that's the case, then he got robbed at the Oscars.
Yeah, I mean, look, the bottom line is that it's a really interesting theory, but there are two things. Number one, if that was what Lucas wanted to do, he bungled it so badly that there's a reason that they made him pull back. And you know, second, that's really a huge dice roll to rely. I mean, if that's really what it was about, it means that Lucas was going to rely, the linchpin of all three of his prequel films was going to be this CGI character that was from a race nobody had ever been introduced to, that was a character that nobody had met before and that people had no emotional connection to going into the prequel films. I have a hard time buying that, even from Lucas.
I would ask who made George pull back, because no one above him was writing the checks.
Well, the story is that came from 20th Century Fox when it came time to distribute the film.
Gotcha. Yeah, I have a hard time buying that. I just, yeah, it's a lot. I mean, he didn't even know what CGI was when, you know, when you created the 4, 5, 6. And if he really did have the backstory in mind, then, you know, it just doesn't seem to flow, you know, and when you put them in context with 4, 5, and 6.
That's true too. That's true too. All right. So, we go through in Phantom Menace, you know, the Gungans, the whole deal with Naboo, you get Jar Jar who comes with them to the Senate, basically. We meet now along the way. Jeff, you were the one who was talking about how, you know, this is the film that sort of introduces us to that backstory that Obi-Wan talks about throughout, especially episode 4.
This is all about the Clone Wars. This is how the Clone Wars get started. We have the setup in episode 2 where you now have a group of separatists who are going to break off from the Republic. And
oh, wait, I'm sorry, Jeff. Before we get into episode 2, we do need to finish. We need to tie up episode 1 a little bit. And I probably jumped the gun by sending us into the Clone Wars a little too heavily first. You know, we do get introduced to it in episode 1, and you're right. I get these all run together for me, so I apologize. but we do get the big first we get a big confrontation between Obi-Wan and Darth Maul, which is this, you know, really a brilliantly choreographed lightsaber battle. We also get now Senator Palpatine has become Chancellor Palpatine. And this is kind of how things are wrapping up. We lose along the way Obi-Wan's master, right?
Qui-Gon Jinn.
Right. So we lose Qui-Gon. Again, there you'll see that the plots of the films are paralleling the later what will be later films, the original trilogy films. So, you know, we have to lose a mentor.
And there's that little bitty interesting in there that Master Yoda tells Obi-Wan that I think I found a way to communicate with Qui-Gon Jinn.
Yes.
It'll play in 4, 5, 6 that, you know, or in 4 that, you know, Luke is able to communicate with Obi-Wan.
Right.
And so forth.
Yeah, it is a nice, convenient thing to be able to fill in plot holes that way.
Yes. When you already know the story.
Right. And in some ways, similar to what you would get later in the original trilogy, we kind of wrap up the film on a you know, with a big celebration. Naboo is celebrating the end of the you know, the Trade the Federation blockade. There's a new alliance with the Gungans, and you know, that's the rousing close of The Phantom Menace. So the question then becomes, end of episode 1, what's The Phantom Menace?
Right, and The Phantom Menace, you know, from a viewer's point of view, is what is this that the Jedi are dealing with? And The Phantom Menace is the entrance of that the Sith are back. They've never went away.
All right, so the menace is, you know, the presence of the Sith, and I guess the Phantom is the reference of the them just sort of being in the shadows. You know, ironically, I guess we get the presence of more Sith lords in this first film than we do the entire original trilogy, but
and even the Jedi are misinformed because Yoda says, you know, there can only be two, never more, but yet. Just going off of that, we know that Darth Sidious would have had to have been training Darth Maul and Count Dooku
right.
at the exact same time. And Count Dooku's, it's training someone obviously as an apprentice as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's clearly more than two. All right. So Jeff, take us into Attack of the Clones. And I guess as I introduced Phantom Menace by talking about, you know, one of its big flaws, I think one of the big criticisms of Attack of the Clones was that of the three movies, it was the one that really was plotting. There was a lot of narrative here. And that's where Lucas's, you know, lack of facility with dialogue really rang through hard.
It's painful to watch the Anakin Padme love story. I can think of oil and water going together better than these two did in this movie.
Yeah, there was no chemistry whatsoever between Hayden Christensen and Natalie Portman.
Oh, it was almost the reverse of magnetic attraction. Magnetic repulsion might be a better way to describe it. To start off with episode two, you've got a separatist group that's breaking away from the Republic, and there, of course, the Republic doesn't want to do that. And it turns out the separatists are led by a Count Dooku. Naturally, the Senate, where Padme is now a senator for Naboo, wants to vote on creating a army to protect the Republic. This army, coincidentally, is made up of clones, which we will find out a little bit later in the movie. But there's a lot of intrigue going on here that really doesn't make a lot of sense. But the bottom line is that Obi-Wan Kenobi discovers that there is a clone army that has already been ordered years previously, and it is being manufactured in time for fighting this war, even before the Senate has approved this. You see the deterioration in this movie of the relationship between the separatists and the Empire, to the point, and the Republic, to the point where war does break out, and you have Obi-Wan and Anakin, who are generals helping lead some of these clone armies in battle.
And what you've got basically are, and it's really sort of interesting. And you know, this movie comes out in 2002, so the timing is kind of interesting too, because you essentially have a proxy war being fought. On the one side, you have Jedi leading clones. And on the other side, you have Sith leading droids. So both sides are fighting wars with, you know, essentially the equivalent of drones or of, you know, mechanized substitutes.
That's true. This is probably the film that seems to be the beginning of Lucas's political statement on the Iraq War as well, because you can tell very much so in episode two and three that he is consciously, unconsciously, it's hard to tell, it's so blatant at times, making a statement about the Iraq War and whether or not that we should be taking part in it or not. But getting back to the actual plot of sure. What's going on here, To jump over a lot of unnecessary plotting plot, what you see at the end of this film is the emperor raises his army. The Senate gives him the power to do so. And Anakin and Padme get secretly married because he has been told by Obi-Wan that a Jedi cannot be in love with anyone. Anakin has decided he will defy the Jedi and do this anyway. Another key thing that gets thrown in here, I think this is in 2 and not in 3, where Anakin discovers his mother is dead. Is that correct, guys? I get confused in that one.
Yeah.
Because there's so much that happens in this.
I think that is correct because
he takes his revenge in 2. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. You see at this point, the first ability for Anakin to reveal his dark side. Because in episode 1, you just see, oh, this sweet little boy. But once you see Anakin take revenge on, I believe it was,
oh, that's right, it's
Jawas.
It's the Tusken Raider camp.
After he discovers his mother's death, that's the first taste of he could be Darth Vader. That's the first time we actually see what Anakin has the potential for.
Right, because he completely loses it and takes his lightsaber to the entire camp, you know, men, women, and children of the Tusken Raiders.
Right. But before we get too far on into this, the best thing about this movie was we finally got to see Yoda in action.
Yes.
We had always wanted to see Yoda in a lightsaber battle, and holy crap. It's like a Mexican jumping bean with a lightsaber going around that room. I remember seeing this in the theater and hearing the entire audience start clapping and cheering when Yoda came on the screen with a lightsaber. So in every one of these movies, there's one or two things that you really want to see. In episode 2, it's Yoda and the lightsaber battle.
Yeah.
Other than that, it's kind of hard to get through this one.
Yeah. Now the other key things in terms of plot here, because you're right, this is a very plodding plot, as I indicated initially, and it's really setting up several things. Number one, you get in terms of the political machinations that are really overblown. The key to it is that Senator Palpatine convinces now Gungan representative Jar Jar Binks Chancellor Palpatine calls for Representative Binks to, make the motion that the Chancellor should get these new emergency powers so that he can, call the secret clone army into battle. So that's one big thing, is that we've now, officially turned the power over to the Chancellor. And although we haven't been told that's what's happened, I think we really now start to get the idea that the Chancellor is about to become the Emperor. And he's not there yet. But I think we're starting to get hints. I don't know. Guys, did you have the impression by this time of what was going on with the Chancellor?
Completely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's kind of obvious to tell even in episode 1 if you've seen Episode 6, the casting of Ian McDiarmid just blatantly spells it out for you.
Well, that's true. That's true. They did a nice job, I thought, of showing him slowly transitioning. Because it's not going to be until the third movie that we really get the big transition. We also see what is sort of the, Actually, this part always confused me, and maybe one of you can help me because I never really got into the extended universe, and maybe that's where it comes from. Why spend so much time worrying about the origin of the clone army, and why does it matter that Boba Fett and Jango Fett are the origins of the clone army? Is there any reason I'm supposed to care, or is it just wasted plot?
I think it's just to tie Boba Fett to those movies.
I think it's, yeah, I would agree with Jeff. I think it's to make up for his sorry death and Return of the Jedi and trying to make him more important in the universe.
Because it's just that whole segment of the narrative is pure flab. There's nothing relevant to anything that happens in that entire chunk of the film that happens on Kamino.
Yeah, because technically the clone troopers are only going to be around for 1.1 movie.
Right.
And then they don't exist in 4, 5, and 6.
Right. And I mean, it's important that they discover that they exist and that they were secretly created. But did we really need to go to Kamino and, you know, spend the night there and go through all of that?
Yes, because we needed to sell some more action figures.
Oh, okay. That's true. And a whole new playset. You could have a Kamino playset now.
And you can sell Slave One.
Right, right. Okay.
And an easy bait clone maker.
All right. And the other then, the last kind of, I think, important thing that comes out of this is we get a couple or one other sort of major, setup. And that is that as the movie is ending, Anakin gets his mechanical arm, which is, you know, sort of a hitting us in the head with a foreshadowing.
Well, not only that, it's hitting us in the head with the parallel between Luke having that happen to him also.
Right, right. That's true, too. And happening in a similar context of the film. Yeah. Okay. And then obviously we kind of end on that and the secret wedding that is witnessed only by our droid friends. Which, you know, got to wonder, can droids witness a legal proceeding?
Well, we could get into an entire discussion about imperial law and robotics, but I think it's outside the bounds of this podcast.
Well, and it would just be, you know, the middle 45 minutes of this film anyway, so.
It's true.
And we've already talked about that.
You're right.
Hey, Aaron, one other thing to add on episode two, sure. On a positive note, is that we're introduced to Christopher Lloyd as Count Dooku.
Yes.
Yes.
You know, just to throw that in there, as Jeff said, the best thing was Yoda with the lightsaber, but Christopher Lloyd was pretty good as Count Dooku.
Christopher Lee.
Oh, Christopher Lee, I'm sorry. Christopher Lee, yes.
That's okay.
Sorry.
Christopher Lloyd was great, but that
back
was...
Back to the Future, yeah.
Yeah, Back
Wrong
to the Future.
Movie, sorry. But yeah, he was great as Count Dooku.
Yes, he was. He was. All right, and, you know, before we leave episode two, I do want to note, we're not the only ones who complained about it. If you look at the theater grosses, this is the first time that we get a sort of bump in the steadily climbing Star Wars revenue stream. Attack of the Clones made just over $300 million, so it made less than its predecessor. And maybe more importantly, it was only the number three film of the year. It made more than $100 million less than Spider-Man. It also made less than Lord of the Rings, even though it opened, many, many months earlier. And it barely made more than Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, which opened 6 months later. So, there was a sign, it was pretty clear that the franchise, you know, wasn't so loved after episode two. But we still had one more prequel to go, and, you know, Lucas was bankrolling them himself, so there was no doubt that it was going to be released anyway. So in another 3 years in 2005, we got the conclusion of the prequel series with the Revenge of the Sith. Now, I always mess this up. So it was originally going to be Return of the Sith, just like Return of the Return of the Jedi was originally going to be Revenge of the Jedi. So they picked up on that and used that title in episode 3, called it Revenge of the Sith. And let's see, I believe that Brett is going to introduce us to Revenge of the Sith.
Yeah, so in this one, so to the point about the second movie, somewhat of a decline, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, so I can't speak to it, but I would have expected that this one would have generated a lot more fanfare simply because we're getting to the conclusion of those prequels, right?
Yeah, and we're back to number one in 2005.
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, looking at this one, it was great. We know where this is going. I can't wait to see this happen. I want to see how Darth Vader comes about. You knew it's going there. There was foreshadowing from, especially in the second one, with Anakin and kind of his, you know, denial of the Jedi. Like, well, you can't do this. Well, I'll show you, right? So there were things there already showing his defiance towards them. And again, that kind of mean streak that he had, for lack of a better term, with, you know, the rampage that he goes on in Revenge of His Mother. So this one, if I put it all together, because between the Clone Wars and this one, I kind of lose some of the details between, you know, the Galactic Empire and the Separatists and who's becoming who and when people get killed, because it does all kind of blend together. But this, to me, part of it was you see the maturation of Anakin, and that he's, you know, he's really proving himself, his capabilities as a Jedi. The Jedi Council is still, of course, apprehensive, like, oh, you're too young, you're still learning, you're wet behind the ears. But they kind of, if I recall this all correctly, they send Obi-Wan and Anakin off to go get Emperor Palpatine, which I don't think was the Emperor at the beginning of the movie yet. I still think he was Chancellor. I'm mm-hmm. not. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they send them out in kind of the Starsky and Hutch of the far, far galaxy, right? and you can see it's almost a good cop, bad cop scenario, which is perfect. You know, even some of the antics with that Anakin does is a little bit on the edge, risky type things. But with this one, you know, you really get to the point where you see one, Palpatine really becoming the Emperor. You see him being the mastermind behind it, and you kind of see his I don't want to say flippant nature, I'm not sure how to describe it, but doesn't really care about the Sith. He knows he's going to have one that he's going to groom and is going to become his right hand man, or in this case right hand Sith, which is Anakin Skywalker.
Now, and the interesting thing is that he kind of has a right hand man at the beginning of this, but he's sort of already decided he's going to move past that right-hand man, because that's what that's the role that Count Dooku's filling, right? He's the next in line to Palpatine at that point. He's the other Sith.
That's right. And I, what's interesting about this one is when we talk about the different things from 4, 5, and 6 and how it has things in 1, 2, and 3 that tie together. Uh-huh. If you look at the Emperor, even in, in the second set of movies in 4, 5, 6, you can see when they get to the point where there's the battle and Emperor Palpatine, even there, even though Darth Vader has overseen, you know, the building of Death Star, all these things, it's kind of like, hey, yeah, if we can get your son to join the dark side, I think he's actually better than you, Darth. So if you can get him over, you die. I don't really care.
It's true. The Emperor's always looking ahead to the next one.
Right. So, and that's kind of the way it looked here. So he had Dooku and, you know, it very easily just said, yeah, okay, we're done with you. I'm moving on. I see this guy has great potential. So, I mean, Palpatine was like a tremendous general manager for the dark side, like an identifying talent and bringing it in. So, I mean, at this point, then you can see he's using let me step back for a sec. So at some point in time, you know, they have all the Jedis spread out across the galaxy, all leading different sections of this war, trying to move it forward and keep peace and bring peace back to the galaxy. And at some point, Obi-Wan and Anakin kind of get split up. So now that Jiminy Cricket version of a conscious that Obi-Wan was for Anakin Skywalker, his mentor, is kind of now losing him to Palpatine, who we all know is a bad guy, but clearly Anakin doesn't really see it. You know, he's just he's being fed all these lines about, oh, well, you know, you should be representing the Jedi Council and you should be a member. And because clearly Anakin thinks that he's awesome. He's ready to rock and roll. I've proven myself, which, again, one of those things when you talk about the foreshadowing, if you think about Luke when he goes to see Yoda and he's like, I can do it, you know, and Yoda says he lacks patience like his father.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it ties that together too. And then the, you know, Palpatine clearly uses all these different motivational factors to basically, you know, pull him into the dark side.
And we see it really clearly when he has the confrontation with Dooku, when he's there to rescue the Chancellor. I mean, it's clear at this point that Palpatine has manipulated this confrontation in order to set up exactly what happens there, which is a fight between them where, you know, Dooku basically challenges Anakin's manhood and says, you know, I can tell you're afraid and, you know, you have hate and you have anger, but you don't use them and that makes you weak. And that's why I'm going to beat you, which is exactly what needed to happen to trigger Anakin's anger and willingness to fight back. You know, he literally unhands Dooku. He's completely defenseless. And then this is where, to me, this is a critical piece of the transition, because he's got Dooku completely defenseless, and Palpatine eggs Anakin into decapitating Dooku, who's completely defenseless. And it's just a steady slide after that.
Well, and along those same lines too, now they didn't show it, but when you talk about one of those things, I'm not sure if this was necessary, but it's one of those things in the movie that still makes me feel awkward, is when they show all the dead Padawans after the fact. It's like,
yep.
Wow, okay, they went there. it definitely drives the point home. I don't know that it was needed. I think you got that point with Dooku and what happened. You know, and even when Palpatine uses his, you know, electric lightning and you kind of see him, like, you can see just the power over Anakin and you can see the transformation. So I don't know. I mean, you can look at that scene one of two ways. Like, well, that was really awesome to drive the point home, or very disturbing. I don't know. It can fall into both buckets. I understand both sides of it, but I personally was kind of like squirmed a little in my seat when I saw that. I was like, oh man. So at least it's not something they showed him like destroying small children. So with this one, clearly you see him flipping the switch, right? So you can see him going to the dark side. And then as you get into this, and I don't remember necessarily the sequence, but we know that Padme had been pregnant.
Well, okay. So we aren't there yet. We know she's pregnant, and that's going to kind of overshadow most of the film, right, is the ongoing pregnancy. And I guess maybe where you were headed here is Anakin's sort of running nightmares.
Right. So he keeps seeing her dying in his dreams. And the other part of this, again, knowing that everything has to come full circle and get tied up here, is not just him becoming Darth Vader, which is the coolest part of it, but is, well, okay, what's the deal with, you know, with Luke and Leia, and how did that all transpire? So, I mean, when you see what happens, and this to me was one of the actual worst lines in the movie, right? is when she actually dies after childbirth, and you know, it was kind of like, it's almost as she gave up, you know, however they phrase it, I'm like, oh man, that is just awful. But I mean, I think they have to tie all those things together. The big part, I thought, when I tell people, you know, about the movies, I say, watch the last 20 minutes of the movie and you'll be set, right? Because this is the, I mean, it's the final scene. It's the battle. It's the Obi-Wan, Anakin, very lengthy, very acrobatic, battle to the quote unquote death. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, to me, this is what it was all about. Right. And I think that George Lucas really started a trend with what he did. I mean, you can say, well, he had 4, 5, and 6, and then he could do 1, 2, and 3. And now he can do, you know, the next 3. But you think about Darth Vader as a villain and people want to know, well, what's the backstory to this, right? Like, how did this, you know, villain come about? And then you've seen movies even like, well, here's the story behind Maleficent. And for example, Wicked. Like, all these different things, it was kind of like people want to know, how did they get from point A to point B? People no longer just want to accept, oh, here's a bad guy. Right? And I think that George Lucas really set that trend.
That's an interesting point. I mean, and there's a lot really that we skipped over that I'll give this film credit. This is the third film. It has the most meat in its plot. You know, there's the most meaningful content in the plot. We kept talking in Attack of the Clones about how a lot of this was, fluff. It wasn't really necessary. It was fat. It could have been trimmed out. You know, in 3, each of these pieces is building something. So the fever dreams about Padme dying in childbirth are contributing. They're pushing Anakin in a particular direction. And it's like all of these things that could have been scattered through the other films are all getting concentrated into the third movie. It's like finally Lucas says, oh crud, I actually have to, you know, wrap this story up. So we'll shove all this stuff in here. And so there's some useful stuff. Because we already, you know, from the sort of scare about maybe, you know, I need to be worried about my wife dying in childbirth because I've got these dreams and I know that Jedi get prophetic dreams. So he's all worried about that. And that is the opening that allows the Chancellor to introduce Anakin to this story of, you know, Darth Sidious, who was a Sith who had discovered power over death and saying that, you know, maybe death wasn't necessary.
Right. And there's an interesting, I don't know if it's a twist, but where he really sells that to him is like, you can save her, right? Just, you know, come to the dark side. It's so powerful. Yep, you can save her. So, of course, and this is interesting, too, because when we talk about, and maybe if they had two different actors, like we talked about the lack of chemistry, it would have been an easier sell. But this is one of those ones where you see the battle between good and evil. It's like, well, I'm going to sacrifice my soul to save her. I'm going to go to the dark side because I love her so much. So if they maybe would have had more chemistry, it would have been so much more believable, easier to sell. And to your point that if they didn't have it so concentrated, like, oh, we got to get these 7 plot points wrapped up within the next, you know, hour, it would have had a different feel to it as well. But yeah, that is clearly what Palpatine really was, you know, the devil on his shoulder saying, hey, look, I can give you all this stuff. All you have to do is come to the dark side, join me, and you'll be set. And we find out it was an idle promise. And even at the end, when he says, oh, what happened? Oh, yeah, you killed her. You went Federation, and you killed her. So, I mean, he continues to perpetuate, you know, these stories to Anakin to keep him, bring him further in, and just kind of harness that rage and that, you know, the anger that he has for the dark side and to accomplish his goals. He's like, well, you're going to be my tool of destruction. So as long as I keep feeding, you know, your soul with these things, that's what's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's also at this point thoroughly poisoned, you know, Anakin, about the need to, you know, deal with the fact, I guess, that the Jedi are, in the Chancellor, the way he describes it is, you know, the Jedi are sort of a fifth column, that they're going to try to overthrow the Republic. And so he suckers Anakin into what you talked about, you know, earlier as sort of, you know, the great betrayal. Because he sends him to literally slaughter the entire next generation of Jedi.
Again, it's just you see Anakin completely turn over to the dark side through these various steps. And you know, if you didn't actually know how it played out, right, because this was a prequel, there's always that part of a movie where you're thinking, like, is he really going to become the bad guy, or is this going to have a happy ending? And, yeah. and there were kind of some things there, for as dark and as twisted and as quickly as it happened, you still kind of thought, because you could see him hanging on to the hope of Padme living and, you know, all these couple of things that were kind of like help him to hang on to his humanity, which clearly was squashed by Palpatine.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So we finally get to, you know, near the end of the film, the, you know, the scene kind of that we've been building to, where first of all, we get another great, Yoda, lightsaber battle, which I think we were all looking forward to. But we get this moment where clearly, Anakin becomes Vader. And I gotta say, although it's an amazing, I think in a lot of ways, this is the best scene in all of the initial three movies, just because it's done really well and you get this really powerful visual of Anakin becoming Vader and where all that comes from. It's also a hard one for kids to see.
Yeah. And that's something, I mean, when I saw it, I think I was around 25 or so when this came out, maybe a little bit older. And again, this is definitely a darker story than the other ones. And when you see the graphic nature behind what happens to Anakin, it's mildly disturbing. I mean, we kind of all, us adults, I mean, we grew up with it. We remember Darth Vader, you know, with his helmet off and what he looked like and everything. So now you're getting to see, oh, okay, yeah, I can tie it all together. Because we really didn't know the full extent of it. I mean, unless you read the different books and things like that. So to see how that actually came to fruition, you know, it really felt like it wrapped it up for me, but it was definitely graphic, and I could for sure, and I don't remember, but I could see some kids being visually upset by that.
Yeah, I mean, you basically get Obi-Wan, you know, slicing off in one graceful motion Anakin's, you know, arm and both legs at the knees, and he falls down an embankment into a lava flow.
Yeah, and right, and but you know what was interesting too about that was the whole time there was a fair amount of dialogue during that battle.
Yes,
right, and I mean the whole time is Obi-Wan was still trying to say, "Don't give in, you know, you can be saved. I don't want to do this." So for it to end the way that it did, you almost like I didn't actually feel bad for Anakin. I'm like, well, if you would have just listened, yeah, you'd be in better shape right now, but we know it had to happen. So
what's interesting to me, right, is that at this point, Anakin is helpless on the banks of this, you know, lava flow. Obi-Wan, who is trying desperately not to be Anakin facing off against the disarmed Dooku, just goes over, picks up Anakin's lightsaber and walks away, which, you know, is an interesting foreshadowing for us who have already seen, you know, episode 4, because we know what ends up happening to that lightsaber that Obi-Wan walks away with. But to me, I mean, that was, I don't know, that was almost worse, right, than beheading Dooku.
Well, I mean, I think it is, because here's, you know, Obi-Wan was his mentor.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the ultimate right there, to just walk away. But I think as much as it was kind of that non-Jedi protocol. I think that was also a sign of, I've completely lost him. There's no hope here. And it's time to walk away from him. Clearly, there was more foreshadowing, as you pointed to you know, what comes of the lightsaber and everything. But I think that was really the exclamation point of saying, we've lost you.
Right. And so at the same time, and this is the really powerful parallel at the end of the film, you kind of have parallel births happening, because in an operating room, you know, on I forget the name of the planet. I guess in Coruscant.
Mustafar, I thought, wasn't it? Was it, she on a starship?
Vader. Vader is actually taken back to Coruscant. So he does get evacuated from Mustafar. In any case, at the same time, you know, Anakin is physically becoming Vader. You're watching it happen. You're watching him have his new arm and legs put on, and he's, you know, physically getting those sort of cyborg pieces attached to him. And while that's happening, Padme is in labor with the twins. Obviously unable to, you know, do any of the things that the Emperor had promised to teach him to do, to cheat death, because he's busy cheating death himself, Padme dies. And the last thing she does is name these twins Luke and Leia. I guess second to last thing. And then the final thing is, she says they're still good in Anakin, although I don't know if we believe her at that point. So then we get to what Brett was saying was sort of the end of the film, which is the transition to Vader is complete. He sits up, and the Emperor kind of cuts off any connection that Vader had with his you know, former humanity, by telling him what?
That he killed Padme.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what's interesting with that, what I thought at least, is that you had Obi-Wan and the Jedi Council saying, you can't be married. You're committed to the Jedi life, right? And then Palpatine just, that same thing, only he took it to an extreme measure and didn't give him that option.
Right, right. And then we kind of get this little, almost feels tacked on, post-log scene where we see, infant Leia getting dropped off on Alderaan, being given to Bail Organa and his wife, who we'll come back and meet again in episode 4. And then also Obi-Wan delivering Luke to members of the Skywalker family, to his Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru on Tatooine. And at this point, it's clear the Jedi are scattered. The twins are being hidden away. And that's kind of where we leave things, waiting for episode 4. All right. So we've walked you through the three movies, and we've set up kind of, you know, this transition from 3 to 4. So now I'm going to have to ask. People want to know, you know, what order to watch the films in, because there are really, I think that there are three primary arguments that people make. One is that you watch them in release order, because that's the way people got to see them. That's the way they were released. That's the way everybody ought to experience them. So you watch 4, 5, 6, and then you watch 1, 2, 3. Now, the problem with that, obviously, is that if you do that, 1, 2, and 3 lose some of their drama, because you already know all the outcomes. There's another argument that says, well, what you ought to do is watch them in chronological order so that the story unfolds in front of you. So you ought to watch 1, 2, 3, and then you ought to watch 4, 5, 6. And then there's the third position, which I happen to be a proponent of, which is what's called the machete order. 4, 5, 2, 3, 6. And then if you really feel the need, you can watch 1. Because as we said, you could really lop one off. It doesn't tell you anything you really need to know. It's sort of like the Silmarillion of the Star Wars saga. And what the effect of that is to make the sort of originally released trilogy the frame, and 2 and 3, it makes them a flashback between Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. So I guess what I'll do is go around and ask people what they think the correct order is. Brett, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I go with the 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, just because of the point you made. That's how they were released. But I don't think there's – I mean, that's why it's a debate and a topic that people can talk about for days on end, is because there's not really a right or wrong answer.
Okay. How about you, David?
I like the machete order, but I think there is a little nostalgia to watching 4, 5, 6. Just go ahead and skip 1 and just do 2, 3. So you have the release order, but just so that you can kind of, you know, if you want to do it, it's just kind of as a throwback to see what everyone had. But the machete order does do a good job of framing the story.
All right. And how about you, Jeff?
I'm a stickler for the release order, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3.
Interesting. Okay. So is it just a matter of tradition and, you know, historical accuracy that, you know, you feel that way, or?
I think that you can see the characters develop better by seeing how they are portrayed in 1, 2, 3 after you see them in 4, 5, 6. You don't see something fully fleshed out in 4, 5, 6, but you start to see the nuances that, if you can call them nuances, that they attempted to put in there in 4, 5, and 6.
Okay.
In 1, 2, and 3, having these numbers go backwards just drives me up the wall sometimes. But it's also partly because that's the order I saw them in.
Okay. Well, that's true. That's fair.
I was going to say air. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And which way would you want your – what would you want your kid to see first? Would you want your kid to see first Naboo or the Tantive IV flying over your head having lights or lasers fired at it? I don't think there's a question there.
Right. Well, I mean, you get that in machete order too.
Right.
Right. Right. I mean, right. And I think that the benefit of machete order is that it makes a lot of the flab of 2 and 3 more tolerable, because you've already got a foundation from 4 and 5, and 5 sort of ends with this big revelation from Vader telling Luke that, you know, he's Luke's father. And then we go to 2 and 3, which are the flashback that proves that Vader's not just posturing, that this is really the history.
Right, but you also got to remember, you can make the flab as colorful as you want, but it's still flab. I mean, your doctor's still got to tell you, you shouldn't eat it. Doesn't matter what time of day you're going to eat it.
Okay. That's true. But again, you still then, in machete order, get to come back to 6 and conclude with, you know, the grand ending. And I think that that ending is richer coming off of and being able to see the parallels and the, you know, the divergence really between the path that Anakin follows in 3, and then you see, you know, how Luke diverges from Anakin's path in 6.
Now, I'm probably going to have something thrown at me over the internet because of this opinion, but I actually think that 3 is a stronger movie than 6.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Because you at least have some emotional darkness that ends in 3. Sort of not on the level of Empire, but it's the best attempt to get there. Six to me comes across as the cherry Kool-Aid dessert after Empire. it's all lovable Ewoks and another explosion of the Death Star.
Okay, so it's just it's too cute and too bow right. on the top.
It's too cute and too repetitive of what happened in 4.
Okay.
Well, I've been converted to the machete one now. but I'll tell you that, for example, my children are now 8 and 11, and I mean it's been a couple years that I turned them on to the Star Wars, you know, the movies. And I did 4, 5, 6, not thinking about going 4, 5, and then 2, 3. But I started off with 4, 5, and 6 because I thought if I start off with 1, this may bore them to tears and they may not have that zeal for the Star Wars, you know, movies and the saga and everything that is Star Wars if I start them out with that. So right. Part of it was making sure that this had their interest. And I mean, truthfully, with 4, 5, and 6, yes, you want to know the background, but you don't need to have the background to appreciate the story of good versus evil and good ultimately triumphing.
Okay. Well defended. So, David, are you attempting to do a full rewatch with the kids before Force Awakens?
We've kind of already done it. We've been doing it over a little bit of a time. But, yeah, everyone is up to date on all 6. I tortured them and made them watch 1, 2, and 3 because, you know, it builds character.
Now, the bigger question is, where does the holiday special fit into the viewing order?
Oh, God.
Okay, so if you've already forced yourself to watch 1 and – you know, you drank enough to get through 1 and you're still capable of operating your computer to download the holiday special from one of the many digital sources where it's floating around. I think that that's the only way to tolerate watching the holiday special.
Or if you want the in-laws to leave early Christmas Eve.
Oh, there you go. That's a great strategy.
Throw that up on the projection screen TV and all hell be Arthur.
Telling you, B. Arthur's scariest role.
You know, I think real quick, I want to say one of the things too about adding it 4, 5, 6, just from a nostalgia point of view. I was telling my children how it really changed the toy industry as we were watching episode 4.
Uh-huh.
That, you know, oh, we had this toy and we had this toy, and you know, we hadn't had anything like that. And you know, we had a 3-foot Darth Vader and you know, there was some of that kind of pumped him up a little bit, but it was kind of a chance to share some of that nostalgia that we experienced when the original ones came out.
All right. So what I want to do to kind of wrap up a little bit, couple of things. One is we didn't actually talk the box office actual numbers for episode 3. So I did go ahead and look those up. And in, 2005, Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith, top grossing movie, $380 million plus. It was number 1 by nearly $100 million. It finished ahead of Chronicles of Narnia, Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, the re-release, you know, the new updated King Kong, Batman Begins. So it held up pretty well, especially bouncing back from a disappointing Attack of the Clones. My question, as we do, we're going to do 2 rounds of sort of wrap-up roundtable here. So the first question is, episode 3 grossed just over $380 million. I want your prediction for the gross from Force Awakens. And Jeff, you go first.
What was the gross for Avengers 2?
Let's see. The Age of Ultron gross. Let's look that up.
Because I think that's the winning one right now.
Yeah, I think it is. Let's see. Got to climb up to that year. Hang on. We're getting there. Okay. Actually, it's kind of not. Because Jurassic World kind of whipped it.
Oh, that's right.
Age of Ultron did $459 million, and this is domestic gross, not world. But Avengers did $459 million. Jurassic World did just over $650 million, $652 million, actually.
I think this is going to be $750 gross.
$750 domestic gross. All right. What do you think, David?
$823 million.
$823 million domestic from David. Interesting. All right. So, Brett, you going to keep pushing it higher?
Well, I mean, I think it's going to eclipse everything. So I'll go one higher than David.
Okay. So you're going for $853 million?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well,
are you going to do $1?
I'm going to go even farther than that. I'm going to go out on a big limb and – I'm going to say, because I was looking at this the other day, as of last week when we recorded the original series show, there had been $50 million in pre-sale tickets sold already. And that was a week ago. So that was a month before the movie was going to premiere. I'm going to say it's going to make $1 billion in domestic gross. It's going to be the first film to make $1 billion. It looks unstoppable and there's very little competition for it at the end of this year.
Take that, Peter Jackson.
So, all right. So last question on the whip around, what's the one thing that you're most looking forward to out of Force Awakens? And David, you're up first. What are you most looking forward to in Force Awakens?
Just to see how the story is going to go to that next chapter. I know it's not a continuation. They're setting up new characters. So just to see where, you know, the story is going to go for episodes 8 and 9.
All right. And how about you, Brett? What are you most looking forward to?
Well, it's kind of a combination thing. One, I want to understand what the deal is with Kylo Ren. And two, how did they go from everything is kumbaya at the end of Return of the Jedi to whatever strife they're dealing with now.
Okay. And Jeff, what are you most looking forward to?
I don't even care what the plot point is. I just want to see Han Solo on screen again.
All right. All right. Well, you know, I think the thing that I'm most looking forward to out of Force Awakens, two things. Number one, I'm looking forward to seeing a Star Wars film in the theaters with my kids. And number two, I'm looking forward to seeing sort of the resolution for all of our characters from Return of the Jedi, you know, because we know that they're using them mostly as a transition. I've avoided, you know, you all know me. I've talked about it before. I'm not a big guy who worries about spoilers much at all. My position is pretty strong that, you know, if it's well-done filmmaking, then spoilers don't matter. And if it's crappy filmmaking, then a surprise doesn't help it. So you know, I normally don't care. And it's not like I've necessarily been really actively avoiding anything. But I've managed to, you know, curb my sometimes need to, you know, dig for details. And so I'm just looking forward to seeing how they wrap up the characters that I grew up with. All right. Well, you know, you all have heard us ramble on talking in a fashion probably similar to the development of the plots in the prequel films. You know, a bit heavy on the flab and not a whole lot of substance. But we'd love to hear what you thought of our ramblings. You can email us at podcast@dizdads.com, visit our blog, dizdads.com, tweet us at dizdadspodcast on Twitter, and participate in the discussions in our forums at boards.dizdads.com. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/dizdadspodcast. Until next time, I've been Aaron Ripmaster with Brett Williams.
Good evening, all.
Jeff Swearingen.
Good night.
And David Nicely.
May the Force be with you.